Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications at TryLifeMD.com? We're now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
It's fun to put on jeans that you couldn't get into 6 months ago.
Every morning, I look forward to getting on the scale.
For anybody who's struggling with their weight, it's a godsend.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
From Geppetto Studios in New Freedom, Pennsylvania, welcome to the Cosmic Geppetto Podcast, your home for inclusive, positive geek culture, where we talk about movies, comics, music, books, and whatever else we feel like. Please welcome your host.
I mean, it's just so big.
Brad Mendenhall.
Hey, kids. It is episode 258 of the Cosmic Geppetto Podcast. Happy to have musician Pete Ferber back to talk about the albums that shaped us. But first, Katie has a question.
What has been the most embarrassing thing you've ever worn?
Oh, that's a good one. What's the most embarrassing thing I've worn? I am hardly a clothes horse. That's a term, right? Clothes horse? I do vaguely remember when I was like in my 20s, I got a pair of high tops that were just real, they looked like moon boots. And I wore them a lot when I worked, because then I worked summer jobs at my mom, the insurance company my mom worked for. And I've always been a Converse guy, but Converse shoes, they're terrible. I would wear the really, like the old Chucks, which are really pretty crappy sneakers. And I was running around all day. I was doing maintenance stuff, so I was walking around a lot. And it was agony my feet, so I just grabbed these old pair of like moon boot looking high tops that my mom got. I don't know why they got me. They must have just been on some incredible sale deal. And they were really comfortable because, of course, they were really thick and I had a lot of support. My coworkers did just like, what's with the moon boots? It's like, they're just comfy. I'm not daring enough in the way I dress to be wear anything really embarrassing. I'm definitely like a jeans and a polo shirt type of dresser or a t-shirt. I've just never worn anything interesting. Like, you gotta swing big to really wear something embarrassing, and I've never been that type. So no, yeah, the moon boot, the high tops, that's what I got. Excited. I cannot express how happy I am to have this return to the Cosmic Geppetto Podcast from
the cover band, 90 Proof. My good friend Pete. Pete, how you doing?
I'm good, Brad. How are you?
I am excellent. It's funny, based on what happened, how this came about is, at a recent conversation with Sean Reynolds, and we were talking, Sean and I were talking about like the first albums we bought. And these are not necessarily your favorite albums. It just happens to be the one whenever you get enough money together to buy your first CDs or whatever it is, and God knows what it'll be for my kids, is what you had money and what you get. So it could be sort of a fun look back. But at the end of the conversation, we said, you know, what we should talk about is the LP you bought, the music that you purchased that was eye-opening and sort of set you on your musical path. I was like, oh, I love that idea. And Sean was actually mad that we just had to talk about the fact that I bought Richard Marx when I was 15, and he didn't get to talk about the cool stuff. But I thought, it's like, this is a great way to get Pete back, because I wanted to have you back for a while, and I wanted to talk music with you. I want to talk about those albums, those sort of seminal albums that you purchased. And you picked two. I think you could have picked a dozen easily.
I could have picked 12 dozen, or 112 dozen. There's so many, but yes, you're right. It's not an easy choice.
And I picked one, but we're going to start with you. Why don't we start with one of them? So you pick two classics.
I think the one that really set me on my musical journey chronologically is the second of the two. We'll come back to the first one, and that's Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, it's a very well-known album. It's one of the biggest selling albums of all time, but it's one that it set me on the way, put it that way.
It's so beloved and so iconic that it's almost cliche, except for it's so damn good.
It's perfect. It's near perfect. In fact, I think it is perfect.
Now, that came out March 1st, 1973. 1973. Walk our listeners through you purchasing this album, and do you remember when you first listened to it? Was it an immediate reaction?
Yeah, it was. I was 14 years old, so that gives my age away, when I first heard it, which I think was probably the year it came out, 73. And I was in the backyard of, we lived in Oxford in England back at the time, and I was in the backyard of some friends who had a bit of money, and they lived in the nice part of Oxford. We came from the poor side of Oxford, but my mother had these friends in the nice side of Oxford, and they had a big backyard with a swimming pool, which back then was quite a rare thing to have. And of course the house faced the woods, and they could put loud music on. At that time I was probably listening to pop music, and suddenly this sound came on. I'm pretty sure it was the track Time, with the strikingly loud and bombastic chords and the synthesizer, the first time I'd really heard a synthesizer, and I just was blown away. I thought, what is this? What is this? But not only that, there was a melody to it that immediately struck me. I don't remember if I went out and bought it that afternoon. I probably didn't, because I probably would have had to save for any number of days or weeks. But I did eventually buy it. It had a gatefold sleeve. It had a prism set on the cover, so it had this scientific, almost futuristic look to it. It was dark. The music was dark. The music meant something. The music was about the future, and I was heading into my future, as we all are, all our lives. And it was about the passage of time, and it was about wealth, and of course it was also about madness. Fortunately, I don't think I was or I ever have been mad, but who knows. But it spoke to me in a way that no other music ever had up to that point. It just captured me, and it set me on a path of, for a start, it set me on the path to being a fan of progressive rock, which I still am to this day. But that was the first thing I'd heard that wasn't just a 3.5 minute pop song that, you know, went verse, chorus, bridge, fade, which was fairly commonplace and had been since the 50s. Now, don't get me wrong, Pink Floyd weren't the first to do this. And as I think I've probably said to you before, a lot of people will say Sgt. Pepper was the first concept album of that type. But Pink Floyd was the first one that I was at an age where it could mean something to me and I could actually understand or begin to understand what it was trying to say.
Well, it doesn't feel soulless, because sometimes concept albums and progressive rock in general, there's so much experimentation, so much doodling and thought put into it, that it can sometimes feel a little mechanical or a little mathematical. Perhaps it's the vocal performance. The lyrics have a bit of gut punch to them. And there's also, every now and then, some of the songs have a little honky-tonk in them. So it doesn't feel dry. It doesn't feel mechanical. Despite, they obviously show a lot of love for the studio in this album.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a studio album. Even though they did try it out on the road before they finally went into Abbey Road and recorded it, famously Abbey Road with Alan Parsons at the engineering desk. And by the way, that set Alan Parsons off on his career as well. That's another story. But yes, it certainly didn't lack soul, but it was precise. I mean, the thing about, I think I've always liked music with precision, music that's skillfully played, music that's well-structured in terms of its time signatures. And there was a precision to Dark Side of the Moon, which was also something that was refreshing to me. It was the first time I'd heard something so precise, but so much soul in there, and so much meaning, and so much depth. Brad, you know what you're like when you're 14. You start thinking that you are the philosopher in the common room at school. And that was an album that you could go and talk to your friends about what it meant. And everyone's ideas were probably way off the chart, but you could start using big words and trying to, oh, my dog just barked, and start trying to be really clever about it. And I think it was the first album that I felt I could actually eulogize, I suppose is the word, to my friends, and they could eulogize back.
14 years old is the perfect time to hear that album for the first time. And I can't imagine what it must have been, because it was new. When I first was introduced to it, the album had been out for literally my entire life. I was born a year after this album came out. There have been so many articles written. I think by the time I was in my teens, they'd already started the whole play it while watching Wizard of Oz. Like, yeah. That's how much navel-gazing had been done to this album. And then every older brother of a friend or anybody 2 years older was already just like hammering you with how to think about this album. You being able to come at it with fresh eyes and not having 20 years or however much of bloviating from previous generation, that must have been so damn cool.
It was, because it's an album that has been with me since it came out, as you rightly say. I wasn't really aware of Pink Floyd as a band. Believe it or not, and this actually astounded me when I read this just a few days ago, Dark Side of the Moon was their 8th album. I thought it was their 2nd or 3rd, maybe. Well, I guess I thought 4th, because I was a fan of I'm a Gummer and Atom Heart Mother, but I didn't realise there'd been 7 albums prior to this. But this, as many people know, was the breakthrough for them commercially and from a critical point of view. You know, it was so well received. But yes, it's nice to know that that album has been a part of my life since then, and still is. I mean, it's still played. I wouldn't say I put it on every day, of course not. But when there's so many, a track like Money, the first track on side 2, we talked about sides 1 and 2 back in those days, by the way, when it was a vinyl LP. But a track like Money is still played daily across the country on every FM station. So it doesn't take long to hear a track from that album on a daily basis. When that happens, I don't switch it off. I'm there and I'm reliving that memory from when I first heard it. It was an astonishing listen. I think that's why I chose it, because I think it's the only album it's the first album I remember. Let's put it, the first album I remember meaning something to me, and has remained that way for so long as well.
Most bands don't have 7 albums in them. Not much less hitting their stride or hitting a new creative peak at 7.
Well, it was a creative peak, although the next album, Wish You Were Here, was equally not quite as successful, but was very successful. But unfortunately, that was the beginning of the end for them. I mean, that was where things started to go wrong. There were artistic differences, as they like to say. As we know, one pretty much hated the guts of the other one at the top of that particular band's lineup. But it was definitely their creative peak, and what a creative peak. And the nice thing is, though, Brad, is that you see interviews with them now, and there's been interviews with them since, where they, despite their differences that emerged later on in that decade and in the 80s, they recognise, all 4 of them recognise, that was... In fact, I think David Gilmour said something like, when we heard it back, we said, my God, we've done something here. They knew it was good. They knew it was going to do something, not necessarily financially, but it did. But on a critical level, it would be so well accepted, and it was. It's great to have heard it played pretty much in its first few weeks of release and still hear it being so important. How many years later? You said, yeah, 49 years later. It's coming up for its 50th anniversary. That's shocking. That makes me feel old. We'll be right back.
it's a gas. Grab that cash with both hands and make a stash.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The trajectory of Pink Floyd, first off, it was Sid Barrett's band.
It was. It certainly was, yeah.
And Barrett leaving, basically getting crushed underneath his own talent and mental health issues, and then it becoming Roger Waters' band. And then Waters being so brilliant, and I don't think anyone would argue so difficult.
And egotistical is probably the best way to describe him.
And then the band being able to continue without Waters, the work they did after Waters left, any other band, it would be a Hall of Fame career. And for them, Division Bell and some of the other work they did after he left, any other band, that would be a Hall of Fame career. For them, it looks like, they limped along. That's how high their peak was.
I don't actually agree that they limped along after Waters left. I think they had hit their peak with Waters, but they were determined not to allow that to be the end of Pink Floyd, which is what Waters wanted. I mean, Waters wanted to shelve the name and shelve the band. The other members didn't want to do that. It was their business, it was their career, and it was a very strong brand name. I do think Momentary Lapse of Reason and Division Bell were a couple of very good albums, but nowhere near as good as the albums that Waters, when the four of the classic lineup before Waters, Mason, Gilmore and Wright, created in that mid-70s period of Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here, Animals and ultimately The Wall. They could have done a lot worse than they did after Waters left. By the way, you mentioned, I want to go back to Sid Barrett. Yeah, he was the founder of Pink Floyd and tragically succumbed to LSD and the effects of LSD in a big way. And Dark Side of the Moon was largely about that. I mean, there were a lot of allusions to what happened to Sid, both in Dark Side of the Moon and Wish You Were Here. And it was very painful certainly for Roger Waters, who was a boyhood friend of Sid Barrett at school in Cambridge. I'm talking about high school when they were 15, 16 years old. That whole thing affected Waters right up to the point that he felt, I've done enough. There's no more we can do with Pink Floyd. It's time to wind it up. And unfortunately, that's not what happened. So Sid Barrett was, despite Sid Barrett not being involved in Dark Side of the Moon, his presence influenced it. His presence was there.
Barrett was just an incredible personality and almost a mythic figure. I remember when I was in London, I saw the play Rock and Roll. It took place in which was set in the 80s, about rock coming to Russia. Like, what the first scene was, Sid Barrett, the character of Sid Barrett, sitting on a wall, singing to the girl that lived next door, and then scampering away like an elfin character in a Shakespearean show. And I was like, wow, that's what Sid Barrett represents to a lot of people. This just amazing, almost magical character because of his talent and also just the effect that he continued to have on music in general, but Pink Floyd specifically, forever. And it's heartbreaking because there was so much more music there. It just wasn't meant to be. And it's one of those things where you wonder, in a more modern world with better understanding about mental health issues and drug addiction and drug treatment, maybe they more could have, something could have been done to help him.
I think the whole band would think that. And I think what happened to him and the fact that he didn't recover, he became a hermit. It is a tragic example of the effects of, I'm not one here to, I'm not going to start talking about mental health and drug addiction because I have no experience, but clearly LSD was a very damaging drug, taken in the kind of copious amounts he clearly did. And also, Sid was also already a fairly fragile character. I think he was quite fun and friendly, a little shy, but he had a fragility that it just took LSD to tip him over the edge. And you know, some guys back at that time made it through, but Sid didn't. And he will forever be remembered as the founder of Pink Floyd and the legacy that was there, that was a presence throughout their career, and still is. I mean, it still is. And really, I think Gilmour and Waters... Well, actually, Nick Mason, the drummer, has been going out on tour with a tour called Saucer Full of Secrets, which is the early stuff prior to Dark Side of the Moon. He's done it fairly recently. I saw him do it about 4 years ago in Akron. And he's been going out with the early stuff that Syd Barrett was involved in, very much even to as recently as three, four years ago, just before the pandemic. His music has been kept, the music he created with Pink Floyd has been kept alive in the live setting. I think it's fair to say that Gilmour wasn't as affected because he wasn't really in the band with Syd. He replaced Syd when Syd was becoming unreliable. For a brief while, there were five members because Syd and Dave were both in the band, but eventually they couldn't rely on Syd any longer, and David Gilmour became the replacement guitarist. So he wasn't really as affected by Sid's illness as the others. And I think he would always claim that the four guys in the band from Gilmour onwards is what Pink Floyd was meant to be, no matter what some people might say Sid wanted them to be.
It's just so funny just hearing just the thought that it was a four-piece band. This music is so big. The four guys didn't play everything. They brought in other musicians and other singers and orchestras and everything else that they did. But just the fact that this music starts from four people and not a big classroom filled with brilliant musicians. I mean, it's just so big. The concepts, the sound, everything. It's just a massive album.
That's partly because of what they did in the studio. And of course, it was hard to recreate that live. Now, if you go and see a tribute band to Pink Floyd, there's usually at least six members. One of the best tribute bands I've ever seen are called Brit Floyd. And they have probably nine, maybe 10 members. I mean, it's a huge band, but they have to do that because their whole raison d'etre is to reproduce the album live exactly as it sounds on record. And they do it very well. But you can't do that with four people. Even Pink Floyd couldn't do that with four people. You could not recreate every sound because there was so much overdubbing. I mean, on many of those tracks on Dark Side of the Moon, there were three guitars playing at the same time. Well, the only guitarist was Gilmour. Apart from Waters playing a bit of six-string acoustic, Gilmour was far and away the only electric guitar player, lead guitar player. So there was a tremendous amount of overdubbing. Nothing wrong with that, but it meant you couldn't do it with four people in a live setting exactly as it was on record.
Former co-worker of mine is in a Baltimore-based Pink Floyd band called Several Species. I know April 2nd in Baltimore at the State Theater of Havre de Grace, they're going to do Dark Side of the Moon in its entirety. And I saw them perform and they were amazing. But good Lord, it wasn't a small venue and it was packed, but it still felt like they had more people on stage than in the audience. Because that's what it took to make this album happen. It's amazing. And it's not really something... I'm trying to think the last album I heard that sort of had that. I'm trying to think who does this sort of big sound.
Well, for me, a classic example, a bit heavier, would be Rush. I mean, Rush do have the same kind of small number of people, huge sound, massive overdubs. Although Rush somehow do manage to reproduce it live. Don't ask me how. With a lot of foot pedals and dexterity. and I think Geddy Lee has seven or eight arms, unlike most of us. But that would be, for me, Rush would be an example of another band with a small number of people that produce a big sound. There's been others, of course. Emerson, Lake and Palmer is another one who could produce huge sound with just a few people.
The lunatic is on the grass. The lunatic is on the grass. Remembering games and daisy chains and laughs. Got to keep the loonies on the path. The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more. And if the dam breaks open many years too soon, and if there is no room upon the hill, and if your head explodes, the dark burns too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He's got a roadmap of Jupiter. Radar fix on the stars. All along the highway, she's got a liquid crystal compass, a picture book of the rivers under the Sahara. They travel in the time of the prophets on the desert highway, straight to the heart of the sun. Like lovers and heroes, I'm the restless part.
That rolls into my selection. And you picked some all-time classics. I chose from 1991, Roll the Bones by Rush.
Good.
Sort of considered their post-classic. A weird point where Rush was in, where they weren't putting out what the Rush diehards would consider their classic albums. Tom Sawyer isn't on this album. It was, they were still putting out hits. They were still selling well. So it was like post-classic, pre... They put out an album, and they go on tour, and they do all their classics, and they do one or two songs off the new album. Like that, it's sort of a weird in-between phase, because it was sort of right before grunge, and Rush had to figure out how to do with grunge. This album, I bought this album because my cousin asked for the album for Christmas. I bought him the CD, handed it to him, he opened it, and it's like, oh, shoot. Like his mom or his brother or whoever got him the CD. He already had it. I grabbed the CD out of his hand. And I handed him $20. He's like, I'll keep it. So I wasn't even planning on buying it. I had heard Roll the Bones on the radio, and I liked it well enough. But I popped it in, and this was a great introduction album to Rush because it was really accessible. No song goes more than 5 minutes. 5.5 minutes is the longest song on there. Which is not a short song, but there's no 10-minute opuses that can sometimes be a little tough to get your head around, you know, when you're 14. I had never heard music like this that was so perfect and so complicated. Like, I had heard Van Halen and I heard Eric Clapton, and I liked those musicians, but it felt like it was all, the music often was a slave to the solo. Often, sometimes the music felt a little rudimentary going into the solo, but this, everything is, especially like the complicated bass and just the amazing drum work and all the complexity and the vocal acrobatics. It was just, I just never heard something so good start to finish and so hook laden. And there was also an eeriness to Geddy Lee's vocals and angelic. And it was like, I've never heard anything like this. And it was pretty amazing. It was an album that made me sort of rethink music, because at that point, I was listening to a lot of rock, a lot of the glam metal. That was a time where Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Poison were real big. Those were often, if not bad bands, but definitely very sort of paint by numbers and not complex. And I never heard complex music like this before.
Roll of the Bones is probably, it's probably in my sort of mid-range of Rush albums. I'm a huge Rush fan like you. And a lot of Rush guys like to, there's a lot of lists of my best, my worst. And Roll of the Bones for me figures out somewhere in the middle. What was interesting about Roll of the Bones, it was a return from that synth period of the 80s that Geddy was kind of angling towards. And Alex didn't really like, because it kind of cut his hard-edged guitar out. And Roll the Bones was really a return to the guitar for the band, and particularly for Alex Lifeson. And I think from that perspective, it marked one of the few turning points in the band's very long career. So it's important from that perspective, even if it doesn't rank up there quite with the top three, the Moving Pictures, the Farewell to Kings. What else is there? My mind's gone blank.
There's so many.
Well, there are. Permanent Waves. There are so many. But Roll the Bones is. I suppose I want to just call it a reliable album from Rush, which is what any of the albums that weren't considered, I put inverted commas in the air, great. The rest were at least reliable. Do you know what I mean by reliable?
Not necessarily swinging for the fences.
That's right.
When you swing for the fences, you strike out a lot. It was just a lot of, to use baseball talk, a lot of doubles. Just like every song was pretty good. As I was sort of re-listening it to talk, I was like, you know, I forget how good Bravado, Big Wheel,
Ghost of a Chance. I love Ghost of a Chance.
Those weren't the hits off the album, but damn, they were some good songs.
Well, I think the only song a non-diehard Rush fan would know is probably Roll the Bones. But I think those of us who do follow Rush know of a few more. But it's not, I mean, I couldn't give you a track listing of Roll the Bones from beginning to end, not a ghost of a chance, without having it in front of me. But maybe I'm not that, I mean, you know what Rush fans are like. The diehards know every song in every order, on every album in every order. And I definitely don't. But like you said, it's got, everything's reliable, and there's a few killers on there. Roll the Bones and Ghost of a Chance for me being the two main ones.
Roll the Bones is a good song, but it is funny. It is the one song on there that it feels like, and every band has done this, every band that's been around for a while, this was Rush's 14th album, which is just staggering. And 14 albums with the same lineup.
I know. It is, that is the staggering thing about Rush, to have maintained that lineup for so long.
They're doing Rush music. But Roll the Bones was the one song. It's like, well, we're going to have rapping in it. It's like, oh, okay.
And isn't that great that they could do that and do it, maybe not tongue-in-cheek, but they would never knock another genre. That's something they never did. They didn't hate punk. They didn't hate rap. Probably didn't hate soul. They liked everything. And they would try and, throughout their career, they would bring a little bit of everything into what they did, and did it so well. Three super blokes that just did it for the love of music. And there were there really weren't any pretensions about those three guys ever.
It felt like a band made of grown-ups. Like three guys who were really good at music. They just behaved well. And I have no idea what it was like behind the scenes. Maybe they were always at each other's throats, or maybe they had big screaming arguments, and who knows what coke they were snorting or what bimbos they were banging. But you got the impression, listening to them, that they all seemed like guys who They weren't interested in being rock stars. They seemed to appreciate what they did. They weren't showy. They weren't bombastic or boisterous. They just seemed like really enjoyable, likable, sweet-natured guys who knew how to work together and be a united front. And I remember distinctly the album after Roll the Bones, Counterparts, which came out in 93 when they were in the heart of the grunge movement. The band had what for anyone else could have been a band destroying conflict, where the band didn't know what to do about grunge because one guy liked grunge, the other guy wanted to keep doing what they were doing. Instead of letting that tear them apart, they just like, all right, well, let's make it work. And they created the Counterparts album that took some of the concepts from the grunge movement and meshed it with what they already did well, and they created something cool. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards would stop talking to each other for 10 years at a time over stuff like that.
They would. And Rush never did that. You're right. They were prepared to let each member of the band go in a direction he wanted to go. And the other two would follow. As long as it wasn't too outrageous, they would embrace every genre they could. As you say, with grunge and with Counterparts, it would always work because it was them being themselves and not trying to be something. Despite following a trend, they weren't trying to be that trend.
They wouldn't follow the trend just for the sake of following the trend.
Exactly.
They would hear something and it's like, hey, let's try it. They were such accomplished musicians. I believe I've heard that they are all like hold master's degree in musician, you know, music and their field. Like, they're just really good. I mean, again, it's like the best dad band ever.
Yeah.
People who are just really good at this. And I think most people who are into music have seen that amazing performer at their local coffee house, or I remember like the local bookstore used to have like local music instructors play, and they were all just astoundingly good musicians. They can obviously play rings around anyone popular that you see in the big stadium. The difference would be showmanship or charisma or whatever. And Rush was the band that took that incredible musicianship and proficiency, the intellectual part. And despite, again, I don't think a lot of girls had posters of Geddy Lee in their bedroom.
No, he probably didn't actually have any made.
Somehow, just the quality and the musicianship, they were in their own way really good showmen. And you alluded to before, seeing them in concert was a staggering. How do you play Tom Sawyer with all the pieces of that song and make it work? And I saw it live and I was like, I'll be damned.
And they are great to watch live because they do so much, but they also send up the live setting. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but you know, when Alex had this huge wall of speakers behind his guitar. Well, the bass player, as you know, usually sends his signal through the PA. So he doesn't have the huge wall of speakers. So what Geddy does is he puts washing machines, and I'm talking about real working washing machines or dryers, even chicken rotisseries, behind his line, in the back line behind Geddy. So they're able to send themselves up beautifully and do it without even saying anything. And Geddy will wear a T-shirt that instead of says Rush, says Rash, R-A-S-H. I mean, that's the beauty of how they don't take themselves. They're very polished and they're incredible musicians, as you said, but they didn't take themselves too seriously.
They just couldn't be any more Canadian.
Well, I've got some good Canadian friends who are going to make sure to listen to this because, indeed, you couldn't get much more Canadian than that.
Yet we've been our wings, flying too close to the sun. If the moment of glory is over before it's begun, the dream is won, though everything is lost, we will pay the price, but we will not count the cost, we will pay the price, but we will not count the cost, when the dust has cleared.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You can stick that claim. Good work is the key to good fortune. Winners take that praise. Losers seldom take that blame. If they don't take that game. Sometimes a winner takes nothing. We draw our own designs. Fortune has to make that rain. We go out in the world and take our chances. Fate is just the weight of circumstances. That's the way that Lady Luck dances.
What's your very favorite Rush album, and what's the one that you just didn't feel connected?
The favorite one is definitely Farewell to Kings, because it was the album which I think was 74, and it, which is very close to Dark Side of the Moon, as it happens. And it's all because of one track, and I hope I haven't bored your listeners with this before, but it's Xanadu. And Xanadu, for me, is the greatest rock track or anthem I've ever heard. And when it starts, there's a 2.5 minute synth salvo that introduces it in a very almost prophesier of doom way, and whenever that synth starts, I kid you not, the hairs literally go up on the back of my neck. There's not many hairs on the back of my neck, but and it has done since 1974. The track blows my mind in how great it is. The other thing is a little bit pompous, but when I was in high school in the 70s, I did study Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem Kubla Khan, on which Xanadu is based, as I'm sure any Rush fans will know. And so it was really great for me to be able to say, oh, yeah, I know what Geddy's talking about, man. He's talking about in Xanadu, did Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure known decree. And this was a kind of a utopia place that was described by Coleridge. By the way, Coleridge was another one that was smoking the wacky-backy opium back in those days. So not only did Xanadu sound great, it had these slightly pretentious lyrics that evoked a poem that my English teacher would encourage me to study. Yeah, the answer to you is A Farewell to Kings, every track, Xanadu especially, 2112, I love. What album don't I like by Rush? I'm afraid it's probably the latter material, Vapor Trails, that didn't really do it for me, but that didn't bother me too much because I knew that they themselves felt they had had their day, and when they decided to hang up their boots, I think everyone felt, after a career like that, let them enjoy their success. Let them retire, just like most 65-year-old guys do, or 60-year-old guys, whatever they were at the time. Not that those later albums were in any way bad. They just weren't reaching the dizzy heights of their late 70s, early 80s successes.
It was sort of what I completely agree with you. Nothing bad. They were still very accomplished musicians. But for me, it just felt like when you have as much classic material that they do, and it just feels like every tour is a greatest hits tour. They are doing two or three songs from the new album, and everything else is the classic stuff. People want to hear Tom Sawyer. People want those classics, and they just sort of sprinkle in the new stuff. And you can tell often when you see those classic bands that they don't even seem that interested in the new stuff, but they'd earned the right to go out the way they wanted to go out. It was heartbreaking when you realize, oh, and they didn't announce the final tour as the final tour. it just sort of, they finished the tour and it was like, oh yeah, that was our last one. It's like, oh.
I think the truth is, I think Geddy and Alex knew that Neil was unwell shortly after that tour and knew how serious it was and that there wouldn't be another tour. And of course, 3 years after that last tour, Neil passed away. Look, none of us knew it. None of us knew it till it happened, because they're not the sort of band to say, to use someone's illness as a publicity stunt. But they did, despite the fact they said they were retiring. They knew they had no choice. Neil's number was up. And that's incredibly sad, because he didn't get to enjoy his retirement. And he was actually the one that was pushing for retirement. He had a relatively young child with his second wife, and you don't want to see anybody pass away in their mid-60s, but that's what happened. And I think that was coming. That was something that was coming that we didn't know about. We the fans didn't know about.
Another classic to talk about. It's a fascinating album, aside from just a quality album, and it's an all-time great, but also where it lands in and what it meant for the artist behind it. So share the your second album.
I will. Well, my first album was one that I heard by chance in someone's backyard. It was blasted out into the fields. This one was more of an influence from an older sibling. I have an older brother, Martin, who is 6 years older than me and is also a huge music fan. He was into the Stones and the Beatles in the 60s, and that's how I, those are the bands I first heard. But then he started listening to this young British guy from South London, had a rather odd look, and he changed his name from Mr. David Jones, to David Bowie. In 71, December 71, David Bowie came out with his, I think, third album, Hunky Dory, and that is the album I'm choosing as the second one that influenced me most. So it was a sibling. It was trying to be like my big brother, I guess. But I also liked it. I mean, I genuinely liked it. I loved Changes. I loved Life on Mars. Still do. Andy Warhol was this fascinating new American artist that David Bowie sang about on that album, in a very amusing way. Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. I think that was the lyrics. But David Bowie was this fascinating character. You know, he was androgynous. He was sexually ambiguous. In some ways, for what was I, 71? I was only 12 years old, nearly 13 years old when this came out. It was also a little bit threatening, I guess, in a way. You know, it was a little bit scary that this guy could...
He was weird.
Yeah, look, here's a guy who looks like a girl and dresses like a girl. What's going on? And to some 13-year-olds, that would be a huge off-put. But again, for me, it wasn't about David Bowie so much as the music and the sound. And Hunky Dory was my introduction to David Bowie. And from that point, I went backwards and forwards and pretty much stayed with him. So, yep, Hunky Dory is my second one. Terrific album.
He was just weird, yet charming. He was a brilliant interview. Like, he was just so disarming. And I recently read an interviewer talking about how he interviewed Bowie a couple times, and he actually challenged Bowie a little bit. He's like, I'm going to be harder on you last time, because last time I didn't hit you with the hard questions because I just thought that you liked me. And I think you do that so people don't ask you hard questions. And Bowie just like looked at him and was like, well, maybe, or it could just be that I sort of fancy you. And the guy's like, yeah, I that was it.
I hadn't heard that. Is that an old interview or a recent interview?
Old interview.
Bowie wouldn't have said that in the last 20 years, but I could certainly hear him saying that in the 70s or 80s. In the early days, his whole aim was to be ambiguous and not care about it. If you don't like the way I look, if you don't like what I say I am sexually, take it or leave it. That's what I am. I was going to say he grew up and changed. No, I'm not saying that changing from one sexuality to another is a part of growing up. I'm not saying that at all. But he did, and he basically became more of a straight guy, both musically and in his personal life. But yeah, he thrived on that ambiguity. and he did use it as his something to be different from many other artists. And interestingly, I feel Mick Jagger saw that, tried to emulate it, and in my opinion, failed. They became good buddies and they did a few songs together, but I think Mick Jagger's androgyny didn't work anything like as well as David Bowie's.
Because Mick Jagger, the androgyny didn't really match the music.
Exactly. That's a very good point. It didn't, yeah.
I love the Stones, but the Stones I love was always the honky-tonk band, the rock band, Bowie. You listen to his music, just had so much more breadth to it. I mean, you listen to this, and I know, like, he composed so much of this music on the piano, and you feel like sort of the almost like stage show aspect to it. And he was never scared to lean into theatricality. So that sort of vibe goes so much better with the androgyny than what the Stones would do. Yeah, it felt a little more forced and just disconnected with Jagger than Bowie. Jagger isn't as charming. Jagger's charismatic, but not necessarily charming like Bowie can be. So he can... So many different things going on with Bowie.
Yeah, and you're right about Jagger not being so charming. In fact, Jagger was relatively standoffish in interviews. But Bowie, who didn't give that many in the early days, but in his later life when he gave interviews, was very, as you said, very charming, witty. He does. There's one interview with Michael Parkinson. Michael Parkinson was the kind of David Letterman of the UK back in the day and was the leading TV interviewer in the 70s and 80s. And there's a great interview with him where Bowie actually imitates Mick Jagger and does it so well. He does an imitation of Mick, which of course loads of people do. But David Bowie is not known to be an imitator of voices, at least not in the spoken voices. And he does a great imitation of a very short, a couple of seconds imitation of Mick Jagger. But Bowie is definitely a more charismatic, I think, and likable. They're both charismatic, but certainly more likable character than Jagger. And I think Jagger was a little bit jealous of that, because Jagger was around first. You know, Jagger was around from 64. Bowie came on the scene in 68, 69, something like that. Oh, yeah.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild. A million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go.
but her friend is nowhere to be seen. Now she walks through her sunken dream to the seats with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen. But the film is a sad thing for she's lived it 10 times or more. She could spit in the eyes of fools if they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those gay men go.
You make a good point about piano. Hunky Dory followed The Man Who Sold the World, which was much more guitar-based. And what I only recently realised was that the piano player on Hunky Dory was one Rick Wakeman, who I actually saw live just 4 nights ago on Sunday night, 3 nights ago. And Rick Wakeman, this was before Rick Wakeman became the keyboard player in Yes. He was a session player. He had just graduated the Royal College of Music in London and was a session player, and Bowie brought him in for Hunky Dory. And when you listen to it today, it shows. It shows it's Rick Wakeman. There's no doubt in my mind it's Rick Wakeman when you hear the kind of piano playing that's being played.
He was so good at that. He was so good at finding talents. He found Wakeman. You and I think before we started recording, we talked about Peter Frampton. Bowie found Frampton.
He did. Absolutely right. Yeah.
Well, my introduction to Bowie was the video for Let's Dance. There you have Stevie Ray Vaughan. And he found these amazing performers and gave him a chance to shine.
Wasn't Let's Dance the one he did with Jagger? Or was it just... I don't remember Stevie Ray Vaughan being in it. You talking about a video or a song?
The song. The song Let's Dance. I think Stevie Ray Vaughan was the guitarist on that, like on the entire album. I mean, imagine finding that talent. And when you think of Stevie Ray Vaughan, you don't think of him as a David Bowie guy.
No.
But Bowie found the talent and made it work and was able to, and Bowie had so much range to, and wouldn't let the fact that, okay, here's this sort of Southern rock guy who looks like he just came out of like a blues bar in New Orleans. Let's throw him in. Let's put him together with the androgynous British guy. You don't think of that as being a natural fit, but he made it work. And he was just so good at finding these incredible talents and making the music work with them.
Yeah, I don't think there were many rock stars or rock icons of any ilk that would have refused to work with David Bowie. And those that didn't probably lived to regret it. More so than any other artist. I think Prince might be up there in the way of attracting people to work with him. But Bowie, everybody wanted to work with Bowie because they knew they would get something that was akin to their own genre of music, even if it wasn't Bowie's. Because Bowie was so open to change and so adaptable to other people's particular musical tastes. So I must admit, though, I hadn't remembered the Stevie Ray Vaughan link. So I will look that up when I get a chance.
Listen specifically to the song "Let's Dance," and when you get to the solo, it's there. I was like, oh wow! Stevie Ray Vaughan had that unique sound, and
that's not someone I've that's one person I wouldn't have put down to play with Bowie, but I'm very glad to hear he has done. It kind of justifies what I just said about anybody and everybody would want to work with David if they could.
What I didn't know, Hunky Dory wasn't a smash hit when it came out.
No, in fact, it only got its chart success after the release of the follow-up album, which was Ziggy Stardust, or given its full name, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. That's what propelled Hunky Dory to the success it eventually did. Sorry, I probably stole your thunder then, Brad, but that's probably what you were going to say.
It's just amazing. Like, apparently the studio didn't know what they had. They didn't want to put money behind Bowie. Him being such a chameleon made them hesitant. The critics liked it. I mean, it was a well-regarded... It wasn't like one of those things where it got bad reviews because it was so different and then people discovered it. It seemed like the people who listened to it loved it, but they just weren't putting money behind it. Ziggy Stardust was such a game changer, and everyone's like, he's been brilliant for a while.
Exactly. It made them sit up and listen.
What's interesting with all three albums that we've talked about, Rush's 14th album, Pink Floyd's 7th album, I'm looking at this was
David Bowie's third, I think, or fourth. He had Man Who Sold the World, fourth, right. In fact, the first David Bowie album, I think, was just called David Bowie, if I remember rightly.
It's just crazy, and it shows how sort of the world's changed. Nobody gets that long to become a superstar. Bowie sold well, but it wasn't until his fifth album, really, that he became an icon. And Pink Floyd going through, basically on the second iteration of the band, and they reached a new peak, Rush, album after album after album. Doesn't, you don't feel like you get, musicians have that sort of longevity. There's no way to make, there's no way to get that sort of impact. The music industry is so segmented. Also, these are albums. Hunky Dory is an album. It has its hit song. I mean, Changes is, it's just a far part of the fabric of pop culture. I remember watching the second Shrek movie, and they had a big scene with to a cover of Changes. But you listen to this album because everything ties together, especially with Dark Side of the Moon, where you have to listen to the whole thing. You just don't hear albums like that anymore because that's not really what the industry is. It's a singles-driven endeavor now.
Yeah, and I think the way he and his producers set up Hunky Dory, starting with a strong song like Changes, throwing Life on Mars somewhere in the middle, Andy Warhol, and ending with the very sad Beauty Brothers, was a great way to make it do just that. You had to go from beginning to end, and you weren't disappointed. And if there's the odd track you don't particularly like, and for me, there is, it's probably Quicksand at the end of side one. It doesn't matter because you know the next song is Fill Your Heart is gonna fill your heart, actually. It did. And then you got the great Andy Warhol song, which I've already alluded to. It lent itself, it was so well set up, it lent itself to a continual 44-minute listen, or whatever, however long it was. Well, not that long, actually. I think I'm exaggerating a bit there. But anyway, you could listen to it in one sitting, just as you said you would with Dark Side of the Moon and with certain albums of that type. Whereas other albums just have the odd 3.5-minute pop song and then something that's just a dirge and you want to drop out of. You didn't get that with Hunky Dory. You didn't get that with most of Bowie's early sort of 5 or 6 albums, I feel. They were so well set up, you wanted to listen from beginning to end.
My first Bowie album, and it just shows the range that his career has had, was Tin Machine.
Now, what that shows, Brad, is the difference between your age and my age. But yes, I know what you mean. I'm being anti-ageist to myself there. Yeah, Tin Machine. But Tin Machine is often regarded. Well, what were you going to say about Tin Machine before I jump in on that one?
It's just so different because it was this weird, angry sort of, and I think it was a reaction to the grunge movement. It was intentionally sloppy, and it was also fascinating because it wasn't David Bowie and the Tin Machine. The band was called Tin Machine. Like the album cover, he wasn't even heavily featured on it. He was sort of in the background. And when it was like three guys in suits and him sort of like in the back, and it was like, eh, it sort of looks like Bowie. After that, he like put out the album with They Say Jump, which had a lot of electronic work in it. The amazing range that he has had throughout his career, and I'm certainly not the first person to call this out, but we talked about how Rush was able to incorporate rap or other stuff into it. No one did that like Bowie. This is a guy where, you know, some of his stuff feels like a Broadway show tunes in the best possible way, and other stuff sounds like something that came out of a Seattle garage, and the other part sounds like it was created on a computer. Nobody ever did that or ever will do that as well as him. It never felt forced. It always felt natural. It just always felt like he was following his muse to wherever it took him next.
But Tin Machine was a great example of where he was prepared to take a risk, because that was, career-wise, a game changer. It didn't succeed, whatever people may think. It didn't succeed commercially, but it had its merits. But not many people would have taken that risk at that point in their career that he did. And that's, for me, shows the bravery of someone like Bowie in being prepared to take risk with his career. And even though it didn't work, even though it didn't work fantastically, it didn't adversely affect his career really in any way.
No, he knew that he had the blank check to do whatever he wanted to do. The fans would either follow him or they wouldn't follow him. And he did it for 2 albums. He seemed to enjoy it. He liked being part of a band. And then he went on and did the next thing. It's so interesting, all the different types of work and all the weird things, like the acting. Somebody figured out, it's like, hey, this guy has more charisma than anybody. Let's put him on screen. And he did weird stuff like Labyrinth,
The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah, Man Who Fell to Earth. He also, God, what was a little more recent? It was one with Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale, where he played Nikola Tesla.
Oh, wow. Yeah, what was that movie?
The Prestige. The Prestige.
I don't think I saw it, actually, but I remember the movie.
Really good movie. It was just brilliant casting. Directed by Christopher Nolan, who best known for doing the Batman films and some other stuff. And it was just a thing where, oh, yeah, Nikola Tesla, David Bowie. That's the most obvious casting ever. And then he also DJ'd. He had a XM radio show, and his breadth of knowledge of music made him a great DJ, and his likability and all that.
Yeah, it would.
Just sort of a fascinating career. Brought a few more people on and put the fear in a whole lot more. Ah, here she comes, here she comes, here she comes again.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Andy Warhol, and it's take one. It's Warhol, actually.
What did I say?
Hole. It's Hole. As in holes. What? Andy Warhol. Like hole.
Andy Warhol, take one.
Ah. Are you ready?
Like to take a cement fix, be a standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are.
But the people. I think if he hadn't passed away when he did, again, sadly, a young age, I think he was 67, I think David Bowie would have gone on to do more in the way of interviewing or mentoring new musicians, and that's a great tragedy because he would have been, because of his personality, he would have been great at that. I'd like to think if he was alive now, he'd be on some sort of a David Bowie TV show that could be David Bowie TV. I mean, it could be his TV channel, whether it's on YouTube or on Netflix. It would be the David Bowie, the senior David Bowie, looking back at his life and helping others achieve musically what he did without fear. I'm not sure if he would have done that, but that's what I'd like to see him doing.
More writing, both autobiographical or just about music. There's also a thing where the appreciation will come in cycles, and people have always appreciated his music. It would have been fascinating. I know, you know, not that long ago, Kanye West did a cut a song with Paul McCartney. No one, I think, would be more adept or a better choice to do something like that than have somebody, an up-and-coming singer, Adele, who certainly has a showmanship to her music that would have been interesting to see her work with Bowie. There's so many different directions it could have gone. Not that long ago, I don't know if it's still on, there's a show called Daryl's House, which was Daryl Hall from Hall & Oates.
Yes, yes, live from Daryl's House, you're right. Great show.
I watched it specifically because it was Ben Folds, who I'm a huge fan of, came and they would sort of interview. And Hall, Daryl Hall, has enough experience and enough credibility from the length of his career where he's able to sort of have these fun conversations. And then they did a Hall & Oates song, and then they did a Ben Folds song. And something like that would have been really neat for Bowie, because the size of his catalog and the different areas, like, anybody could go on his show and pick a song that works for them. Oh, that would have been so awesome. Now I'm bumming myself out.
But as we alluded earlier, nobody would refuse. I mean, nobody would refuse to go on David, but live from David's house. No, it would have been, people would have been lining up at the door. I really believe that. Daryl did a good job, but he's not quite up there in the A-list. David definitely was, with the McCartneys, the Springsteens, and the Dylans of the world. He was up there in the very, very top of the A-list of stars, and it would have been a great show. You're right. It would have been great. Makes me almost tear up thinking about it not happening.
And I love Springsteen. I love McCartney. I love Dylan. But even them, if you're Kanye West, Adele, BTS, I don't know, whoever is popular within the last 5 years, they don't necessarily work as well. Like, there isn't a Dylan song that sounds like Adele, but you can find a Bowie song that sounds like Adele, and you can find a Bowie sound that sounds like, you know, K-pop. There's so many natural fits for his music.
And so many people that would have loved to have him do recreations of what they did, as well as them do recreations of what he did, and bring it together as one. It would have been fantastic. Not to be, sadly. We've talked about Syd Barrett, David Bowie, and Neil Peart tonight. It's a pretty depressing lineup when you think about their untimely demise.
Well, it's the hardest thing talking about music and musicians. Not all of them hit their 80s.
No, sadly not.
I was just talking with somebody not that long ago when I was talking with Sean, my friend Sean Reynolds. We talked about the iconic MTV generation big stars from the 80s. And you were looking at Michael Jackson, Prince, Whitney Houston. I was like, oh, none of them made it to their 60s. George Michael passed away. Basically, from that particular MTV era of star, who do you have left? You have Madonna and Bruce Springsteen. But Springsteen barely counts. He was somebody who was already established in the 70s. But there's just something that really, that particular batch. And it's like, oh, that sucks.
You're right. It wasn't empty. I never think of that as in terms of the MTV era, but that's a good way to describe it. Those artists who are now in my kind of age, I guess, their 60s, and there are a limited number of them left, sadly.
But the music continues.
Yeah, I was just about to say, there are some great, I still don't think music is as good as it was when I was younger, but everyone says that. My parents said that about classical music and how much they hated pop. But there is good music out there. There are people coming up. There are some great young bands and singers, Adele being the primary example of a fantastic artist with a great charisma as well. There's hope for us yet.
I'm going to tie this all together. 90 proof. What songs from these three performers would you want 90 Proof to do? You have an amazing 90s cover band.
That's an incredible honor to be asked that question. For those who don't know, I am the bass player in 90 Proof, a local band in Northeast Ohio, and we do specialize in 90s. From Rush, it would be Xanadu, which I certainly couldn't sing or play. From David Bowie, oh, wow. I do love Absolute Beginners, which was actually a track from a very unsuccessful film of the same name. Or rather, a commercially slated film of the same name. But that song is an amazing song. And if anyone hasn't heard it and is just thinking of the movie, please listen to the song Absolute Beginners. That's one I would do by Bowie. It's got a fantastic groove. And from Floyd, well, I'm glad to say that in a previous band, not very well, but I did play Time in about 2000, 2001, that kind of time. I was in a scratch band we put together for an event, I think it was, and someone suggested we did Time. I didn't sing it, but I played the bass. So I have played a Pink Floyd song from Dark Side of the Moon. And I think if I did it again, it would be Time once again. This is the thing about Roger Waters. He's great songwriter, great lyricist, not an amazing bass player. So someone else who doesn't consider himself a highly talented bass player, playing Roger Waters' bass lines is relatively easy, certainly compared to Geddy Lee's.
No, yeah, good Lord. That's, yeah. Oh, it's funny, because I play guitar with the guys that I play with. We sort of switch it up for a couple songs because our bass player wanted to play some drums and our drummer wanted to sing. I was like, oh, I'm going to need to play the bass. And I own a bass guitar that I never play. And we decided to play Dead Leaves on the Dirty Ground by the White Stripes. A song, by the way, that doesn't have any bass.
Right.
Which gave me a whole lot of range. It's like, it ain't like I'm not going to sound... it ain't like they're doing anything in the song that I can't do because there's nothing there. Okay, yeah, I can do this because it was very much, all right, we go A, D, G, dun, 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 and just do that all over again. I was like, yeah, I can do this. If it was me playing bass, there would be no Geddy Lee. Just very basic.
Well, I'm going to interview you for a second then. Which of those three artists' songs would you want to play with your band?
From Rush, it's not one of the hits, but I mentioned before on Roll the Bones, the song Bravado. And I'm a sucker for songs with, this sounds worse than it is intended, but like a, sort of like a drone to it and a circular feel to it. And that's a song that has just a great locomotion to it. And then sort of beautiful lyrics. I would put the guitar down. We're four piece and I play rhythm guitar. And honestly, that song does not need a rhythm guitar because the bass is so rich and the guitars are so rich. It's like, and the lyrics are, the vocals are not easy. And with my guys, I sing. So I would put the guitar down and I would just like really try to belt it out and do it justice because I think I would probably break something singing, especially if I was trying to strum a guitar at the same time.
Right.
With Bowie, I'll go a little different. It was his post Tin Machine work. He had a great song called Jump, They Say. Now, it's a very electronic song. I think it'd be really neat. I love songs that have that production that you strip down. And there's a really cool lyricism and progression there. And it's like, I think it'd be fun to sort of take that and strip it down. This isn't anything inspired and it's been done 1,000 times. Wish You Were Here is just a beautiful song.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
And it's one that everyone hears it. And not just that people know it and not just people that react to it. But it's a song with an emotional punch. You see, when people hear that song, they get dreamy. They think of someone. Everybody thinks of somebody when they hear that song.
And I think that's the same, actually, with Shine On You Crazy Diamond off the same album. It's a song that makes you think of someone that's struggling. Because that was specifically about Syd Barrett. So that's a song that does that for me as well.
Yeah, so what we'll have to do is one day we'll have to figure out some PA Ohio connection, and we'll have to get both groups together, and we'll put on a show, and we'll just do those six songs, and then figure out a set around it.
Yeah, I mean, we could meet in mid PA somewhere, and 3 hours each, 3 hours drive each. I'm sure we could do that, Brad. That would be awesome. We should we'll think about it and try and get that together one day. The meeting of the minds and music.
That'd be awesome, Pete. This has been amazing. It's been too long since you've been on. I'm glad you came back. I need you to plug your pluggables. Where can people find out more about 90 Proof?
I'm going to get this right this time. 90proofohio.com is the website. 90 Proof Ohio is the Facebook page where our gigs are listed. We have a couple of gigs coming up in May, and I don't have the dates in front of me. I always do that. I think it's the 6th and the 20th of May. We're playing in at the Basement in Twinsburg on one of those nights. And we're playing at the Greenville Inn in Chagrin Falls, two of our regular haunts. But the website and the Facebook page will keep you up to date. We have fun. We've been together 6 years now. As I said, mostly 90s music. We feel we do it pretty well. We do it good justice. We do a bit of Foo Fighters, a bit of Jim Blossoms, quite a bit of Bare Naked Ladies. Our singer is a huge Bare Naked Ladies fan, so they get 5 or 6 airings in our set list. We mix it up. We try and bring in at least 6 new songs every year. I would say our set list has had a complete change round in the 6 years we've been together. We have plenty of songs in our back pocket at every gig. Yeah, if you're in Northeast Ohio and you want to check out a 90s tribute band, that's us, 90proofohio.com.
Well, recommend everyone check it out. What's the Gin Blossoms that you do?
Till I Hear It From You. And
Hey Jealousy?
Thank you. And Hey Jealousy, yeah. I think there might be a third one, but those are the two that are currently in the set list.
Till I Hear It From You is a favorite of mine, co-written by one of my favorite musicians of all time, Marshall Crenshaw.
Yes, I only discovered that in the last year, I'm astonished to say. That was great little bit of knowledge into the back of my mind.
And I'm going to do something I have not done before on this show, but I'm actually going to do it. Pete sort of mentioned, and I've talked a little bit about me and some friends. We get together and we play. We're actually, and possibly by the time this episode comes out, we may have done our first small gig. We're looking to do basically just a 20-minute set at a place that lets local bands, gives them a shot. It'll be our first time playing in front of people. I always have to tell this story because I'm a little embarrassed by it. We got together and we were playing around, and we've been playing for a year. Basically, it was just something that we did during the pandemic. We was like, well, we should have a band name. And I had my suggestions. And then they turned around and was like, you know what would be a good band name? Mendenhall. That's a good name. And I was like, wait, what? It's like, that's going to make me sound like an ass. It's like, we're okay with that. If people go on to facebook.com/Mendenhall .the/band. You can see us, and you can find out when we're looking to start playing in the Baltimore Central PA area. So yeah, the Mendenhall, the band that makes me sound like an ass.
No, it doesn't. It's look. I mean, some of the best bands were named after the David Bowie has always been a band, but it's David Bowie. It's never been anything. Well, apart from it was Tin Machine. There's nothing wrong with being the Mendenhall band, and it also indicates what they think of you as a guy, and that's in a positive way, I'm sure. Good luck. Good luck with the Mendenhall band, Brad.
We're gonna keep in touch, Pete. This has been awesome. True story. When we started talking about playing out and getting it together, you were the first person I contacted because you're such a joy to talk with, so kind and so giving. I knew that you would guide us in the right direction. And I have a neat setup in my basement with the speakers and everything else. And so much of that was from advice you gave on how to put together like a good practice space.
Oh, wow. Well,
we would not have lasted a year if not for the advice and guidance you gave us.
Well, you are too kind. I'm actually a technophobe, so it's a good thing I didn't give you too much advice. I have to have other people help me set up some of my instrumentation or pedals, you know, things like EQ. leaves me cold. But no, thanks for saying that. It's a pleasure to talk to anybody that's starting out as a band. I've done it a couple of times, and it's a great thing to do. As we used to say in the UK, when music was being mimed by so many bands, keep music live. Keep music live. Go out and play. It's just such a refreshing thing to do. It brings people together in a unifying spirit. And I love live music. I can't get enough of live music. So I'm glad you got it together, Brad, and you got a band out there. And I will really make an effort. I'm retiring in a couple of years. So I will make an effort to get out there and see you. It's not too far, especially if you're in mid-PA.
Well, there's always a spot for you in my house for you to crash. I would love that.
Well, that's awesome. Very kind of you. Yeah, always good to talk to you too. And I do enjoy it. And I look forward to the next time we have a subject we can have a natter about. Natter, there's a British word for you. Natter, talk.
What are we coming to? No room for me, no fun for you. I think about a world to come where the books were found by the golden ones, written in pain, written in all by a puzzled man who questioned what we were here for. All the strangers came today, and it looks as though they're here. Faces in golden rays.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper?
a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
That wraps episode 258. Big thanks to Pete Ferber. Great guy, and so happy to have him back. Also big thanks to Katie for another great question. There are more where that came from. Next time on the Cosmic Geppetto Podcast, Tennessee-based trio Dallas Ugly joins me to talk about their new album, Watch Me Learn. Till then, in the words of Jarfart,
see you in the funny pages.
Subscribe to the Cosmic Geppetto Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever quality podcasts can be found. Rate and review us while there. Follow us on Twitter at Cosmic Gpod, and we will follow you back. Unless you're a jerk, we don't follow jerks. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Cosmic Geppetto. We love hearing your ideas for upcoming episodes. Email us at cosmicgeppetto@comcast.net.
Unfortunately, I don't think I was, or I ever have been mad, but who knows?
to stand within the pleasure dome decreed by Kubla Khan.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry,
sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.